introducing tonight and my sponsee Clara organized all of this, and I'm very terrible at responding to emails, phone calls, and if you text me, you might get a response. But due to the fact that we saw each other all the time, she knew I would do it, even though I never responded to anything she sent me. I met Jennifer last night, and what was interesting was we were dressed almost identically. We were wearing black boots, jeans, black T-shirts, and leather jackets. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, this woman has style. And I've talked to her a little today, and she's someone who I want to get to know better. And I know she loves this fellowship and this program, as I do. And I'm known as the Gestapo at Rebo's. And God has brought me a long way in order for me to get sober here in America. And I have never met finer people than the folks in Alcoholics Anonymous. And here's one of them.
Hey, everybody. I'm Jennifer. I'm a very grateful alcoholic.
Hey,
woo. And I'm nervous. Okay, so I'm going to start with sort of a funny story about that. That last year I was supposed to be here, but I didn't return text or calls or emails until I got a phone call a week before from John S., who you might remember as last year's Saturday night speaker. And he said, are you speaking on Saturday night at the Marietta Spring Roundup? And I said, I am. And he goes, no, you're not. He said, I am, because you won't return a damn phone call. I called my sponsor promptly and said, okay, I think I've hit a bottom with the whole not returning phone calls. I'm probably the only person I know that's been kicked off of a speaker. I have another funny story about speaking at a meeting. When I first moved up to North Georgia, I had, for the first time in my career, I had an executive assistant who was very serious about being my assistant. And I'm super bossy, but I didn't quite know how to use an assistant. And so I was at a meeting, and they asked me to speak at the regional meeting. And so I told them I just need to check my schedule, but I'd be honored. So I get to work a day or two later, and it's on my calendar. And I said, How is this on my calendar? And she said, they called. And I said, well, who's they? And she goes, those AA people called. And I said, the AA people called? And she goes, yes, I'm your assistant. They're supposed to call me. And I was like, well, what did they ask? And she said, they asked if you could speak. And I told them you needed 3 hours and an LCD projector. Oh, my God. Please tell me you didn't say that. She said, I did, because that's what you need. Like, and I said, what did they say? And she said, they said they'd get back to me. So they got back to her, and they said I could have an hour and a half, no LCD projector. So until that time, like, I would go to meetings, and you could tell the people that were on the committee, they'd be looking at me like, there's that asshole that thinks she's going to have 3 hours to speak, right? And I was like, that wasn't me, that was my executive, which also sounded a little asshole-y, so... Sorry, Blue, like rule number one, I'm not supposed to swear when I'm up here, so I'm going to start over again. I'm Jennifer. I'm a very grateful alcoholic. When I first told my story the very first time at the Clarkson Group, which was my home group for many, many years, the Clarkson 12-Step Group, I was there at that moment to tell my story and share with you my brilliance around Alcoholics Anonymous. And 5-10 minutes into the talk, I just flipped out and stepped off the podium and went into room 10, for those of you that remember Clarkson. And my sponsor trailed in behind me, and you know how your sponsors are always like, it's exactly what God wanted you to say, and it was beautiful. And she said, it was exactly as bad as you thought it was. So she gave me a couple guidelines, things to say and do before I speak. One was to not swear. The other was to say, I'm Jennifer, I'm a very grateful alcoholic. Sobriety date is July 6, 1987. And the other was to read something from AA, from the big book. I have always read this one particular thing, but I found something about a year or so ago that tells the story of July 6, 1987 and who showed up here. So this is actually from the fourth edition. And it's in a chapter called My Chance to Live. I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous at age 17, a walking contradiction. On the outside, I was a portrait of a rebellious teenager with miles of attitude to spare. On the inside, I was suicidal, bloodied, and beaten. My stride spoke of a confidence I did not feel. My dress was that of a street tough kid you didn't want to mess with. Inside, I was trembling with fear that somebody would see through my defenses to the real me. If you saw who I really was, you would turn away in disgust or use my many weaknesses to destroy me. One way or the other, I was convinced I'd be hurt. I couldn't allow that to happen, so I kept the real me veiled behind a force field of rough-edged attitude. And the last line, I think, is what says it best. How I got to this place is still a mystery to me. I've said this about 10 times this weekend, I want to thank everyone that asked me to be a part of this again. It really, truly shows what amends means, and I am very honored that you allowed me to do this, to have this opportunity again. All jokes aside, it's not deserving. And for the speakers this weekend, thank you. I've said a few times that Katie and my story is, in so many ways, almost identical. And Katie and I didn't know each other. And don't know each other super well now. Know each other. She's with people that I love very dearly, are very close to her, and obviously Alcoholics Anonymous is very dear to her. But when I say it's creepy how much our stories are alike, it is really, really bizarre. And so I've kind of wondered, like, how do you tell the same AA story? And then I heard her speak again, and I realized something really important to me, that you can start from the exact same place. And we all have a very similar story of that story of our bottom and what alcohol did to us and how we lived our lives. And then there are two women that stand before you this weekend who couldn't be in so many ways more different and touched by the same amount of love and touched by the same gifts of this program and the same people and the same 12 steps. And it has affected our lives in ways that are just incredibly powerful and stand before you two very different women. And what I was so afraid of when I got sober was that my life was over. It hurt bad enough that I was willing for it to be over. But what I thought I would have to become was sort of a robot. And I thought, you add these ingredients and out will come this incredibly boring human being that goes to Denny's on Friday night like all of you. With terribly, terribly, terribly unconditioned hair and really just bad cars and many things that I did not want. But what I wanted, I saw in specifically in this one woman named Darlene, who is my sponsor. What I wanted was her smile. And I say this every time I speak, that I would have gone to the ends of the earth to have what she had. And I saw it the moment I saw her look at me. And I'm so grateful for that powerful connection, because I would do anything she said, which is a good thing because she was quite the tyrant. With her bad hair and bad car and a beautiful smile, she had a lot of rules. And there's another part I read before I start to speak. It says, what at first appeared to be a flimsy reed. And I remember for my first four years of sobriety, everything you said seemed to be such a contradiction of an incredibly flimsy reed and this mysterious thing that was almost seemed magical that I that worked when I did it. And the power behind picking up cigarette butts still mystifies me. I had this time where I was in treatment and I was furious and angry at work. I had a terrible job. I was in a really bad outfit. I had a bad perm. Everything was bad. I'd gotten off the MARTA bus. I was late for community, which if you've ever been in a halfway house, you know that is not good, with a bunch of rabid women. And it was my turn to go to the grocery store and get the shit for dinner. And so I go to the grocery store and I get the stuff and I grab a cart and have to take, I don't have a car because life is just treating me awfully. So I take the cart and I take it to the apartment, and the cart's got a broken wheel. And so I'm like doing this number and I'm so pissed. And then it starts to rain and I'm like, of course, right? This is fantastic. My life sucks. taking the stupid cart. I bring the groceries. I throw the cart behind the apartment. I walk in, and they're all sitting there, as they all do. We're concerned about you and your commitment to your community and your sobriety, in which I promptly told them what I thought of all of them. And then I called my sponsor, sweet little Darlene, and her pretty smile. And I told her how much I hated them, how much I hated my life, hated my day, hated everything. And she said, "What did you do with the grocery cart?" I said, "Perhaps you need me to slow this story down a little bit. I threw it behind the apartment, and what does that have to do with anything?" I think that was probably the number one thing I said to my sponsor in my first copy. "What the hell does that have to do with what I'm telling you?" And she said, "You need to take that grocery cart back." And I said, "Well, it's raining, and I'm not. It's broken." She said, "It's not your grocery cart." I said, "I'm aware of that." And, and she said, "How many grocery carts can your backyard hold?" And she hung up on me. And I just sat there like, oh, my God, I hate you so much. So I went outside, and I got that stupid grocery cart in the pouring rain with the bad perm, and all the women like, "You have to cook." And I took it back and threw it. And about 6 months later, I figured out what she was talking about. Right. Well, first of all, I took the grocery cart back. Right. And that's really what most of my early sobriety was about. Father Martin, some of you may have heard his Chalk Talk tapes back in the day. He always said, it's the things that we're doing that we don't know that we're doing that make us different. And so first and most important, I took the stupid cart back. And then she said, how many more things can you be pissed at? Like, how much more room is there inside of you to hate because it's looking a little crowded, you know? And then the other was simply, like, it's not yours. Take it back. And it was years, it's been years and years of lessons like that for me. I heard it said so beautifully about, I'm in kind of a transitional period, if you watch Pulp Fiction. I'm sort of a transitional period right now emotionally. So we have a lot of Kleenex up here, which I believe somebody, thank you. Kind of thinking about just another, we keep going through these ebbs and flows in our sobriety, and I'm sort of trying to understand what it is I'm so afraid of losing when it comes to my sobriety, besides the obvious, why I feel like it could just be taken from me at any moment. And when I got sober, I was terrified for the first couple of years that this wasn't going to work for me. These flimsy reeds were quite cute and magical after I did them, but you didn't understand the way I drank. And you didn't understand the darkness that lived inside of me and the heinous things that I had done. I was not one of those 18-year-old kids that got sober that people were like, "Why are you here again?" They were like, "Here's your seat. Just don't talk. Don't bite. Just sit." Right? It was clear that alcohol was never my problem. It was always my solution for this unbelievably horrible skin that I carried around with me. And it saved my life in many ways, and then it stopped working in a way that I can't even describe, and the loneliness after that, and what I was left with the wreckage, and what I was left with the lack of coping of any sort of life that I had, it just ate me alive. And I had this weird problem of not being able to stop drinking. And when I say I couldn't stop drinking, I don't mean like I would say, like, I'm going to quit today. I mean I couldn't stop drinking. Like, I couldn't not put, and again, I always do this. Like, I feel like I have to slow it down for y'all when you know exactly what I mean. But I couldn't, it's still fascinating to me. Like, I would be drinking, throwing up, and drinking. And just, like, stop drinking. I couldn't do it. I couldn't stop putting the glass to my mouth. It was, it owned me. It consumed me. And it destroyed any hope I had of learning any other coping mechanism. And so all of that came rumbling into the doors and sat down in the intake office of Decatur Hospital on July 6, 1987, and was terrified that they would think I wasn't an alcoholic. Because if they found out what I really was, they wouldn't let me in. Alcoholism would have been a step up for who I had become and the things that I had done, and not always because I was drunk. The things that I did, as a matter of fact, drunk, were just drunk and stupid. the things that I did without a drink were vicious and hateful and terrifying and life-threatening and all those other things. So when I say that I felt like this thing could be taken from me and nothing seemed like enough and I wanted it so badly, it's still to this day, I still worry. You know, am I going to enough meetings? Am I working the steps? Am I talking to my sponsor enough? Am I good enough? Do I deserve the mercy that has been given to me by Alcoholics Anonymous? And lately I have been reading over and over again a quote from Shakespeare about mercy, and what he says is that that none of us should see mercy, right? Not in the course of justice anyways. And what I guess where I'm getting tripped up around what it is that is required to stay sober is life's lessons that have always been required at each different time of my sobriety. I've been sober now. July will be 32 years if the good Lord willing and the creek don't rise. And what it was required to stay sober at a year, what was required to stay sober at 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, all of those things have been important. And when I try to apply what I had to do then to what I have to do today, literally, I get mixed up because all of those things have changed who I am today. What I know to be true is I need the echo of you no matter what. I need to be in your presence to say what I'm thinking and for you to say back to me, well, that doesn't sound quite right. Or, I understand, you know, or we have a solution for that. Or not say anything at all and hear somebody share what our gentleman just said when he picked up the big book. Our old timer said, I found all my answers in this book. And he said, will you show me where they are? That's what I needed to hear tonight. That level of beauty, of courage, of I'll do whatever you say. Just make it stop. You know, I've tried everything. You're handing me this book. I don't know who you are, and I don't know what the hell I'm doing here. But will you show me what page number to read? And that miraculous expression of grace to me is the most beautiful part of being an Alcoholics Anonymous. That I hope to continue to be able to see. And so, you know, who I was when I drank, I don't know that that is even sort of important, except to know that I belong standing right here, right now, and there are people in this room that were there when I got sober that could very much attest to that. But what I can tell you is the story of a woman who, when I stop working the program, what happens to me? Because my alcoholism is alive and well today. And I am very fortunate that my disease responds very well to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It responds almost instantaneously when I work the steps, when I tell the truth, when I feel the love that you guys are giving me so freely. It works very quickly. And I believe that is what time offers us, more resilience to what happens here. But when I stop working the program, and whatever that means, maybe I'm not going to enough meetings, or maybe I'm going to a shit ton of meetings. Shit appears to be the word of the evening. Whether I'm calling my sponsor, it's what I'm supposed to be doing right now, what my work is today. And when I set my work aside, whatever that is, which ultimately is to work the steps and to hear your echo and in you find my God and be connected to grace. Whenever I stop doing that, oh boy, right? You better recognize like that whole, like, do you know who I am? Or like, that is my parking spot. Or like, oh hell no. You know, that whole, like, that, it's like that. It is, or spirals into the depths of, we were talking earlier, I got to tell you something that I got to do today. So the other thing my sponsor always told me to do before I spoke was to say the third step prayer on my knees and to say it with somebody. Today, I got to do it with five women that I love so very much, out loud, around a bed, all clothed, pretty much. And I almost couldn't say it because it was so beautiful. I love you ladies just so much, like with all of my heart. And I have absolutely no idea what I was just talking about before I talked about the naked bed thing. It wasn't naked, though. I was saying something super important. When I don't do the things that I have to do in order to hear the truth about my relationship with alcohol and drugs, I get very, very sick very quickly. And angry, restless, irritable discontent. It is the state. I remember what it was. So I was on a plane the other day, and I've been on lots of planes. And I was tired, and I'm in my transitional period right now of, existential crisis, fifth dimension kind of stuff, right? Very powerful, go to more meetings kind of thing. And and I am having a true meltdown where the guy next to me is like, don't look at her, don't look at her, don't look at her. Make no eye contact, and I'm crying. And I am 100% totally worthless, right? Totally worthless. And my disease says, as quickly as you can imagine, you want to show I'm worthless? Let's get shit-faced right now, right? That is how my disease is alive and well. 31 years of sobriety. The best way I can describe it, and I'm not an IT genius, I know that might be hard for some of you in here that know me to believe, but there's this thing called the Facebook, right? And when you're on Facebook, it pays attention to what you're doing, and then it sends you messages like cookies, right? It, like, eavesdrops on your shit, and then it sends you, hey, you were thinking about Hilton Head. There's a nice hotel in Hilton Head. My disease is like a cookie, right? It just gives me no privacy. I didn't sign the whole, like, privacy, please. I'm here having my own private little meltdown. Dude next to me is giving me privacy, and my disease is like, let me attach to that story right now in a way that is sophisticated and sounds exactly like something I want. It sounded exactly like what I wanted. And I could, because I'd been restored to sanity, because I prayed that morning, because of this unbelievable gift of grace that I have, which lets me hear my disease where I couldn't before, I was able to hear, wow, that was a good job. I mean, that was good, quick, responsive, very fast. That sounded a lot like me. And, you know, so when I got sober, I remember them saying, and they still say this a lot of meetings, that the only way that we can stay sober is to do step one 100%. And I remember thinking, oh, good, the first thing out of the gates, 100%. Perhaps we haven't met. But I don't do things very well right away or forever, ever. So I knew I was going to fail because I couldn't do the first step perfectly. And I get what we mean by that. But what I believe, and this is my version of the steps, in case you were wondering why you were here tonight. I believe it's step two that keeps me sober. Right? If I'm not restored to sanity, I have absolutely no idea what it means to be powerless and what my life is unmanageable. And it's through the eyes of step two, through the insanity, being restored to sanity. And I don't mean what we call insanity in meetings, that nice saying that we say, which I believe totally. It's the same thing, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. I love that saying. But when it comes to step two, I believe what they're talking about when it is insanity is the alcoholic mind. I believe that's what More About Alcoholism talks about so freaking beautifully. I don't know any other piece of literature, any research, any science that's been done that describes the disease of alcoholism more beautifully than More About Alcoholism does in the big book. So that's where I'd start. That chapter, More About Alcoholism, in the book that you just won. that I signed. This is super scary. Just cross that part off. So it talks about the alcoholic mind, and it's the thinking that precedes the drink, and that we think is the crux of our problem, right? It's that thinking. And something happened for me on July 6, 1987, the only thing I know to call it, which is grace, where all of a sudden I was able to hear my disease talking. And there was no answer back. There was no maybe tomorrow or another drink or good idea, let's start that later. It was just dead silence. And all of a sudden, I knew I was in a lot of trouble. And ever since then, because of what Darlene taught me and the sponsors since then have taught me, which is every morning when I wake up, I have an untreated disease. My disease has never been treated by the 12 steps, not today, because today I'm a different person. I am in ridiculously high heel shoes, right? I don't do that. I'm in a dress. I'm different today. And in this dress, it makes a lot of sense to do a ton of methamphetamine before I should come up here and talk to you. It just makes sense, right? It would fit better, everything about it, you know, and that's the story today. You know, it's whatever it's going to need to do to pitch to this woman that stands here today to get me to go back to take a drink. And then the drink takes a drink, and the drink takes a man. And that's the allergy that they talk about in More About Alcoholism. And so what happened for me and what I believe is why we celebrate our sobriety dates, again, this is my opinion, isn't because whenever I say how long I've been sober, most people, there's a typical response, which is, were you like 4 when you got sober? Like in some sort of way, I was fortunate to be an 18-year-old alcoholic. Katie remembers this too, but because when you get sober young, you hear all day long, all the time, you are so lucky. Mm-mm. I did not feel lucky. You were lucky. You got to drink for like 20 more years, right? That's lucky, right? My ship sailed at like age 15. That sucks, you know. I didn't feel lucky. I felt angry. I felt deprived. I felt all the things that you just tried to pat me on the head over, and there was no head patting. I was mad. I was pissed that it had happened this young. So I don't know about those of you that when you pick up your chip, lately, the longer I've been sober, the more awkward it feels to pick up a chip, and everybody applauds, and you're sort of like, yay. It's just like a weird feeling, and yes, I understand, but what I'm celebrating and what I know you're applauding for now is July 6, 1987, not 31 years of sobriety. It's that date happened is an absolute miracle. And I want to remember that day every single day, because something on that day that should have very well happened in June, I promise you, or at age 16 or 17, long before July 6, 1987, there was no event that occurred on that day except the most powerful event, which was grace. And now all of a sudden, I could hear the truth about my relationship with alcohol. And there was this restoration to sanity. And so I remember walking up to the nurse's station on when I was in treatment and saying to the nurse, I'm going to get drunk again. And she said, right now. And I said, no, not right now, but soon. Like, I don't know if you've met, like, have you read my chart, but I, like, drink a lot for no reason. And I'm going to do it again. And I just heard this great lecture in there that told me I have a disease. It's fatal and progressive, and I'm going to die, and that's not going to stop me. Like, nothing is going to stop me. And she goes, but not right now. And I was like, oh, Jesus. No. Again, I have to slow it down for y'all, but I'm locked in a treatment booth. But we're going to need to come up with a long-term plan where I'm locked up. And she said, honey, you're getting it. I think probably the most important word said to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, except it was in a treatment center. You're getting it. You get that you can want to stop drinking. And as Clancy says, not drinking has no effect on alcoholism except to make it worse. You can want to stop drinking, and it will have no effect on alcoholism because you will forget that very quickly. And somehow or another, I knew that. It was like somebody handed me this big book and said, here, read this. This is you and alcohol. And it was like about 8,000 chapters. And by the time I was on chapter 36, I was like, oh, shit. This is bad. This is really bad. And the weight of the rest of the chapters, I knew what was coming. And the more my alcoholism was revealed to me through being restored to sanity, the more desperate and terrified I got. Because I would drink for no reason. And I knew something powerful had to intervene. And it just so happened there was a really cool little caveat to step 2. It came right after it, and it was step 3. And it said that I could make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as we understood him. Now that was going to be a good time. All right, I had a couple issues around that. I got sent to a homeless shelter when I had a couple months sober because I wound up in the woods with this boy. That's another story. I loved him very much. And he loved me. And when he told me he loved me, I told him back, I love you too. And then I couldn't remember his name. So some things don't change quickly. So anyways, off to the homeless shelters where they sent girls who went to the woods. And at the homeless shelter, I got a smidge psychotic because I would have chapel twice a week and romance novels unlimited. And I decided I was Jesus's wife. And no AA meetings, no sponsors, no echo, except for the women of the homeless shelter, which were totally cool with me being Jesus's wife as long as I gave them their breakfast in the morning. So it worked out really well. So this book tells us that my job up here is to tell you about my relationship and how my relationship with God and what that's looked like over all these years. And there, I can tell you right now, is not enough time. Not the whole weekend, not enough time for this unbelievable relationship that I've gotten to have. But what is important about step three, where the story started for me, was around what the 12 and 12 says. You know, I remember hearing over and over again that my will had no place in AA. But that is not what it says in the 12 and 12. From what we know, from what the guy had hogged every present, he got that 12 and 12, the new present. In the third step, in the 12 and 12, it says on the last page, it says that it takes sustained and personal exertion of will. And what somebody taught me about step three was it's really not about picking God. That's like not your business. Step three is about how do you demonstrate your decision? How do you take the grocery cart back? That's all you need to worry about with step three. And for me, my first example of step three was sitting with my back up against a tree, making the decision to go to the homeless shelter. And I just knew I had to go. See, I'm from Dunwoody. So I thought for sure my mom wouldn't let me go, but they drove me out. So that's where I went, to the homeless shelter. But and for me, the other thing that I love about your echo is watching Will and Grace in action. Not necessarily the TV show, but the movement of Will and Grace, right, where the actions that we have to take come together with the miraculous gift of grace, and how those two absolutely never separate. I try to see how they separate. I try to see, like, okay, this time it's all me, man. I got it. It's me, all sustained in personal exertion. And then there's that sort of lurking question of, how did you know? That's grace. You know. And sometimes grace is more. Sometimes it takes more grace, and sometimes it takes more will. And God, as I understand him, is that intersection of will and grace. And the reason why, for me, that target keeps moving is because I understand God differently when there's more grace in my life than I do when there's more courage in my life or more will. And so God, as I understand him, moves. It is a relationship. It's more fluid than just a religion or a husband. We got a nasty divorce. My sponsor told me that he wasn't my husband, and that was pissed me off. And I got back to meetings and started to look a little bit more closely at my relationship with God. I was back in treatment, and my roommate was raped in the middle of the night. I was in one room, she was in another. And when she woke me up to tell me what had happened, he had been there for hours, and it had been a pretty brutal experience, a very brutal experience. My bed was shaking, and she was smoking a cigarette. And I swear the first thing that came to my mind was nothing, absolutely nothing happens in God's world by mistake. And I was so pissed. And I said, well, then I'm not down with that, because I don't want that God at all. And so when I called my sponsor after, you know, different things happened, the police came, and what she said to me was, the big book is the first 164 pages. That's somebody's opinion. You'll come back to that one day. Right? And I did. I got to come back to that one day hearing Dr. Paul share. And what he said was, that's not what I meant. A whole other story of what he said he's experienced since he wrote that was women and husbands and wives and mothers and fathers writing him letters saying, my child was hit by a car. Help me understand what you meant. And his opinion at that point in his sobriety was that a lot of crap happens in man's world by mistake. My experience was, as a result of that episode, in her life, I fell in love with her in ways that I never would have known how to love another human being. And she walked through something that I didn't think anyone could sober. And other people loved her. And I got to see God's world versus man's world. Which was, the solution wasn't that a sugar daddy would make the bad man go away. The solution was, in my God was probably going, what the hell happened? No, that's not what I meant to happen. And then there was this beautiful outpouring of love. And one of my favorite sayings that Bill Wilson says, which is, in God's economy, nothing is wasted. And it's in that that I find redemption and you people and the echo and the love of what happens when life shows up at our doorstep. Just because I'm sober doesn't mean that life doesn't continue to happen. It does. And I've been given the tools and the gifts in which to feel them richly and deeply. And it should be terrifying when something like that happens. It should be heartbreaking to see another human being lose their child. Or it breaks my heart to love the way that I love. There's a guy I get to go see on Monday, Stephen. I know him. He's amazing. He said one time in a meeting, the price of love is grief. And that is the truth. And there are many of you who have taught me how to pay that token. And I'm so grateful for that. You've lost people that you love deeply. And you've walked through the other side of love and in your own struggles and wound up on the other side of it still loving. And all that because I put down a drink. It doesn't even make any sense to me. 1 + 1 does not equal 2. So how do I demonstrate my decision? Is I just roll straight into step 4. And when the steps are read before I speak, if you're somebody like me that is all about you, before you speak, one of the things I was taught how to do is I listen to the steps being read and I let them wash over me, and a memory of each step pops into my head of a time I worked it in my life, different times. And what pops in my head every time I hear step 4 read is passing out because I'm so exhausted from writing the 4-step, because we all do it the night before our 5th step, right? That's when you do your 4-step. Crying and just snotting everywhere and like waking up with the paper stuck to your face. Has that ever happened to you? And I'm like, what happened? Did I just finish that? But this one particular 4-step comes to mind, and there have been many since I've been sober. And every single one of them have been, the 4-step is my way of removing the barriers so I can see the truth, so I can be in the presence of this gift that is grace. I sort of talk about this more with work. I don't usually talk about it much in AA, but the way that I see my sobriety is that this whole room right in here is filled with truth. Everything in this room is true. Everything. The molecules, everything. July 6, 1987, I got kicked into that door into this room. But when I landed in here, I came with all these stories and all these things that weren't true. And so I was blocked a little. I still had the opportunity of grace, the opportunity of truth, but I couldn't see it completely. And through the echoes of your stories and through the exchange of my perceptions, I slowly got more and more acclimated to what truth looked like and to grace. And I've got more affected by it. And the longer I stay sober, the work of the steps is to move everything out of the way from truth and grace. That's what the work of the steps do for me. That's the magic in my sobriety of how my alcoholism is treated. But when I start lying, I start moving the wall back out again. And there's different types of lies, right? There's cash register honesty. There's, which I can struggle with all the time. I'll tell you a story. Bernadette and I were just sort of talking about, just it's remarkable how we can, our titanium steel rationalizer. I was told something at work one time. I was on the leadership team, and I was told something at work that was, you know, not to be shared. So, of course, I called somebody to tell him about it. And it was very important for him to know. And he no longer even worked there, so I, you know, give him the down and dirty. Do not tell anybody. Like, you better not freaking tell anybody, because, like, I don't. And he's like, all right, I won't. So he calls me back a couple days later. He goes, well, you don't have to worry about me telling anybody, because Dana told me in the parking lot of Kroger. And I was like, are you kidding me? Like, she told you? So off to the HR office I go. I'm like, you are not going to believe what she did. Like, she freaking told dude doesn't even work here anymore. Like, what the hell's going down here? I'm just horrified at her. Like, I don't even understand it. So HR was like, we will handle it. I was like, damn right you will handle it. Right? So then my boss, like, stops me in the parking lot. She's like, I do not know what is wrong with my team. I cannot believe she told. And right when she said that, I was like, holy crap. This is like Dynasty. This is like I like told. I'm not telling her that, of course. I'm inside going, see, I got to go to a meeting, right? This is with a number of years sober, and so I have to go and make amends. And I should very well lose my job for this. So I go to HR, who's the woman's not in AA, and I tell her what I've done. And I'm sure that she is going to go, oh, good God, you are spiritual. Like, whoa, in here, risking it all, making amends. I am, wow, so impressed with your sobriety. That is not what happened at all. Like, she, no. No, it's not what happened. She was like, what the hell is wrong with you? It's hard to explain. A lot of work goes into not doing that. That's all I'm saying. So then my boss comes in, and she's like, this is not okay. And here's your final written warning. And you're not on this team anymore. And I'm like waiting for the end. Wait, work the steps, right? None of that. None of it. No super impressed being sober girl. So I can build those walls back up and not even know that anything's happening. I can lie. So that's the cash register honesty stuff, which is sort of can be black and white 4 or 5 days after you've done it, sometimes quicker. The work that I do today and have to do on a regular basis is the truth about who I am. So see, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a seventh grade education. Remember saying to my therapist, I got out just in time, because it was like Monday or whatever was my sobriety date. Wednesday I had an appointment, because that's what I called it, to start prostituting myself. It was an appointment, official job interview. So thank God I got here on time. And my therapist said, wow, you are a prostitute. You're just not a very well paid one. And he was right. And how do you miss that? Like, how do you not know that you're prostituting yourself? How do you not have any idea that that's who you are or what you'd become? I thought I was ignorant, a whore on the street without Alcoholics Anonymous. And there came a time in my sobriety where that was not the truth anymore. And I had to stop saying that. There was more to me than simply the fact that I didn't pick up a drink anymore. And circumstance rather than virtue is another line that's in that 12 and 12, which I believe in very strongly, but there was a point where I started to turn that on me and say, there's nothing about you that's worth anything. The only reason you're doing all this is because you're afraid to get drunk. And that's the barrier that started to build up between me and Grace. And as I started going to school, and I would get A's in my classes, I would say to my husband, I got to take that class again, because I fooled them. Every single time I fooled them. They felt bad for me. They gave me the A. And he would say, we're not taking that class over yet. You got to get rolling. Like, let's move. It took me 8 years to get my undergrad. And my sponsor finally said, is it possible that they are more qualified to decide your level of intelligence than you? And I was just like, I guess that's possible. She goes, okay, good. But you see, I couldn't even accept what I would earn. I didn't even earn it. I still, to this day, have dreams that I didn't graduate from Georgia State summa cum laude, which I actually did, that I had failed a class and I had lied about it, or that I was cheating on a test and I'd gotten caught. It's still something that's hard to believe that truth about me, that I had the discipline to go and do that, and that I had the discipline to go and get my graduate degree and have that same experience and be changed by literature and beautiful things about learning. And I remember standing the day I was graduating in the library. This was at Georgia State. And around, it was in the library around, they have books in the library, lots of them, which was always overwhelming to me. And I remember turning completely around and looking and saying, I haven't read one of these books. And I'm graduating summa cum laude. How is that possible? And I got officially what I guess you're supposed to get, which is knowing you don't know shit, you know? But there's so much to know. But that's not what I thought it would look like when you graduated. I thought I would have mastered every one of those books. I would know more, and I would know how to do it. And instead, what I was touched by the beauty of all of it, and the history, and the discipline of experiencing that education. But then the work became, now what are you going to call yourself if you're not stupid? Right? Now what? So I remember doing, I'm getting to get back to that four-step, this four-step that came to me when we were, I'm not, like, reading my text messages, I'm just seeing what time it is. But there are a few on here that are very distracting. I had some, and I don't usually talk about this either when I share, but there was some, a lot of things that happened in my childhood that I was, that I hear that we can't recover from, right? So sexual abuse is a part of my story all the way up until I walked into the doors of AA. And I had a sponsor that was very, very, very rigid on how I was going to deal with that, and that was through the steps. And I had a therapist who was very, very rigid about how I was going to deal with that, and that was inner child work and all that therapists do, and not talk to your mother, and, you know, and all those kind of things. And it was that balance of in between the two where I found the truth about how to find some healing around that. But what comes to my mind is a four-step that I did on these, specifically on the abuse. And it was written pretty much like this, you know, like, I effing hate you, and just dumping. And when I went to Laura to say I was ready to do my four-step, she said, yeah, I'm not going to hear your fist up. Gay G is going to hear it. And those of you that know Gay, she was my grand sponsor. It's really not the way that I would have liked to have gone to Gay's house and shared. She was a lady. She was a lady. And she sat at her piano, and I read that four-step to her. And with all of the beauty that Gay possessed, she took that information from me. And she said, so now is 6 and 7, right? And you have the opportunity to forgive the unforgivable. And Gay gave me the gift of step 6 and 7. And she said, I don't expect you to know how to do that. That is what 6 and 7 are for. Do you want to forgive? And I wanted to forgive so badly. She said, well, then good, just ask. Beg. Plead. Do whatever it is you got to do. And then move on. And I will always be so grateful. I can still see her today sitting there in all of her flowy outfit and beauty that Gay had. So 6 and 7... have been an important part of all of my transitional periods that I've had in my sobriety. The longer I'm sober, the more I realize that step 6 and 7 are the real deal. That's what it's really about for me. 6 and 7 are about my character defects, like 1, 2, and 3 are about my alcoholism. And there are things about me, there are things I think in all of us, this beauty of darkness and light, this duality that we experience of sort of wanting to do both. You know, when I first got sober, I stopped stealing because I would get arrested. And I didn't want to get arrested. And that's a really good reason to quit stealing, right? And then I was sober for longer and not stealing. And then I stopped stealing because it wasn't mine. And that's a very different reason to quit stealing. And then later I stopped stealing because it was actually yours. That's a really different reason. And then I stopped stealing because I didn't need it. And it just keeps growing, right? And that's what 6 and 7 have offered me, is that space, that time to be impacted by it. There's a modern artist that says that painting like this is easy unless you know how to paint. And not lying is easy unless you know how to lie. Not stealing is easy unless you know how to steal. And I haven't forgotten how to steal, and I haven't forgotten how to lie, and I haven't forgotten how to, you know, how to do all the things that I know how to do. Today I get to choose like Steinbeck says, right, that there's this beauty in choice, and that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me, is I get to choose, do I steal or not steal? Do I lie or not lie? And every day are choices, still for me. I have not been rendered white as snow. Bernadette and I were talking earlier, too, about I will say that I have done worse things sober than I have ever done while I was drinking. And that is not anything I'm proud of. But it is the reality of who I am as a human being. And I have sat in meetings. I remember this one meeting, and with these tiny little chairs. You ever how you show, sometimes you show up at meetings and they like have the kindergarten chairs and you just sit in them? And I just sobbed and sobbed for what seemed like months. And members of Alcoholics Anonymous just sat there with me. I would hear How It Works read, and it was like the most beautiful thing I'd ever heard, and all I could do was cry. Because I couldn't believe who I had become and what was happening and how I was coming undone and how nothing seemed to make it work. And 6 and 7, I was on my knees, banging on my bed, screaming at God, you have got to take this away. And it is the thing that I've struggled with my whole life, which is I want more. I want to be the prettiest girl in the room and the smartest girl in the room. And I want everything more. And Bill Wilson writes about that really beautifully in Emotional Sobriety. And he talks about what it means to have this absolute dependence on other human beings, to feel good enough, to feel okay enough. And I'm just at another level of that today. And my work is a little bit different than it was on those days. Right? There's more of it than then. So I'll go to the men's steps have been an important part of relationships for me. I did some things to my family that I can't say that I that were because of my alcoholism. I don't know what they were because of, but I did some really, really shitty things to my sister in particular. One of them being that I told my whole family that her husband raped me, and he did not. I've been told to probably not share that from the podium too much because there are women who have been raped and to not trivialize that, and I agree with that, especially when I sat in rape support groups for my first couple months of sobriety. That's who I was. I know, I have heard, I have seen the level of desperation that women and men experience from that act, and I just threw it at my boyfriend's face one day because I wanted a fight to stop. I was just like, I'm like this because I was raped. I wasn't. I slept with the man, but I did not. And it was early in my sobriety where I had to make amends to my sister for that. And my sponsor taught me something about amends on that when it came time, because I was going to be with her for a week. And she said, I don't know what to tell you to do about that. And I didn't know what a huge lesson that was going to be, that we don't have to know the answer to everything as sponsors. We can ask for permission to ask. And so she said, can I ask my sponsor, who was gay? Gay told her exactly what I was to say, nothing more, nothing less. And I sat on this picnic table with my sister, and I said, I'm not the sister I ever would want you to have or should be, and I lied. And she just looked at me, and she cocked her head, and she said, I love you. And the part about step 9 that I don't know that I can ever get over is how incredible human beings are and how incredibly forgiving they are and what love does. And my sister, this woman that was capable of love, and nobody went to her wedding. Nobody saw her first child be born because of this. And she just said, I love you. And that was my sister my whole life, and I totally missed it. I had no idea who that woman was. And she loves me deeply today, in spite of the fact that I never call her back or return text or anything. And I love her very much, too. And I fell in love with my husband while I was married to another man. There's your shit right on the street, homewrecker. He wasn't. He ran away from me. And I hurt that man that I was married to very much. And I went to my sponsor with my 8-step, and I said, how do I make this right? And she said, this one you don't make right. You live with this. And I was like, I mow his lawn or, you know, I don't know. Something, there's got to be something that I can do. And she said, what you will do is you will live with this truth about yourself, that more meant that much to you. And I had absolutely no idea what the depths of that amends would mean for my relationship with Steve today. And we've been together now for 25 years. 20, I should know that. 25? I got it? Pretty close. He apparently has two birthdays, too, which I can never remember. One is his sobriety date, and it's just, one day I came home, and I said, how was your cigar you smoked? He goes, it was good. I said, which one did you smoke? And he told me, and I said, I thought you were going to smoke that on your birthday. And he just looked at me, and I went, oh. I knew it was your birthday, I just didn't know it was today. And he was like, yeah, that doesn't count. I went to go get a card for, like, I'm sorry I missed my husband's birthday. You know they don't make those? They have lots of them for the husbands, but not for the... So, anyway, the amends to Bob has been an amends to Steve that I have failed at in so many ways. And I think I've done okay in other ways. There are people in this room that I love so much and have loved me through every bit of that. My best friend Patty sits here. She's heard me tell my story so many freaking times, y'all. And there couldn't be anybody more different than me than her. I'm just so grateful for all of the people that have been put in my life, all the women and the men and the God of my understanding and love. I am alive today because of the love of you people, of the courage it took for that little 18-year-old girl to show up in treatment. I get so tired of hearing us talk about what pieces of shit we used to be, because the truth is that girl saved my life. And I will owe her forever. 31 years ago, I don't know if I could do what she did for me today. So, Jen, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You will one day look back at the woman that saved your life, and you will feel the amount of gratitude that we all feel today for that. Troy? Did I say your name right? Is it Troy? Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll tell you what they told me. You never have to drink again. The war's over. It really does work. And the steps will provide you with so much more than not taking a drink. I am grateful to be here. I am so grateful for your willingness to hear me speak. And thank you for asking me. That's it.